Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 31st, 2005. This morning's session, Elimelech takes off his shoes. Ruth 4, a Bible study presented by Dan Erlander in the Fireside Room. Disc number ERD 2005-13. Let's listen in.
This is the third session of our series on the Bible. I forgot what this was called. But today we're going to look at Ruth. And the thank you for coming in spite of the boring title that you heard it at breakfast about Elimelech. I'm sure everyone has wanted to learn about Elimelech, so thank you for coming. Because a better title would, we're going to do the Ruth and Boaz love story today, which is a marvelous story in the Bible. But before we begin that, I would like to share a hobby, one hobby I have, and that is collecting obituaries. And this started when someone handed me a rather interesting obituary during the campaign for the last presidency about Gertrude Jones, 81, who passed away, and then blah, blah, tells all about her family. And it says, memorial gifts may be made to any organization that seeks the removal of President George Bush from office. And I said, oh, that's interesting. I wonder if there are more interesting obituaries. So I found some more, and then a friend on Whidbey Island, Jerry Hansen, reads obituaries, and I found her to always be out the lookout for one that is unusual, which she has done. And so I'll read a few to you. This is a Richard Joseph Davidson, and it goes. He was a big time brewery regular and all around miscreant. Did I say that?
Miscreant.
His more creative projects include a personal hydrofoil, a rear steering unrideable bicycle, a collapsible yurt, a walk-in pinhole camera, and a square round triangle peg puzzle with only one peg. And then it says, a good riddance party will be held at the big time, date and time to be announced. This is Margaret McGilly, born 1935. She seemed to know her long and extremely courageous and determined journey dealing with health problems was about to end as she hosted a pre-wake party on her birthday. I have to share this. I have one cartoon. I want to share these two women on a porch swing. And they're talking, and one says, I went to my HMO doctor today. And then the other woman says, I think our doctor is an HMO, but Frank thinks he's straight. Okay, here's another obituary. Here it is. This is a Robert Bauer Sr. Went off to play with his old dog Rachel in that big field of daisies in the sky. Good theology. He had four children, son Bob Jr. being the brightest of the bunch. And if anyone disagrees with that, they can write the next obituary. And it goes on to say at the end, listing all of the survivors, including son Bob Jr., the literate one. Okay, that's then one more. A light here is. Okay, this is Arnold Kopker, local booze hound, dies. Do you believe these are really in the newspaper? I have to get to the light here. Leaves behind two wayward children, one compensating son-in-law, two obnoxious grandkids, a stubborn sister, and a whole bunch of unpaid debts. Get your claim in early. And then finally, this one. Mother, grandmother, sister, aunt, friend, beautiful, talented, character, loyal, opinionated, Democrat, optimist, adored John F. Kennedy, despised Ronald Reagan, adopted every conspiracy theory that came to her attention, smoked every cigarette she could buy or find, and the Supreme Being must have greeted her with the observation, "You were a hoot." One of Mary Jane's final questions was to ask about the arrival of her absentee ballot. Okay. Enough of that. By the way, the second to last one I read was the Lutheran services were at St. Andrew's Lutheran Church in Bellevue.
Wow.
You're familiar with that? One interesting thing about obituaries in the Northwest, which Washington and Oregon are called the nun states. Have you heard that?
Mm-hmm.
And there's been writing, and it was shown on the recent, or the current Newsweek that is about spirituality in America. And it has a map of the United States and the majority denomination in each of those, in each state. So, like, the only one that is Lutheran is North Dakota and South Dakota. And then it shows all over the country, then gets to the Northwest, and it says none states. And it's what it is, and it's what's amazing if you're from the Midwest is I looked at the obituaries in our local paper, and probably one or two out of 10 have a funeral that has any connection to a church. And then that's where you really get a sense of the population. Do you think that's, do you agree with me with that?
I sure do.
And that's also, I think, why you get these crazy obituaries. I don't think you'd find as many in the Minneapolis Tribune. let's move to our story for today. Let's see. I put up some dates here so you could kind of fit things into history. Where we were yesterday, and then where we are today. Yesterday we talked about the fall of Ashdod, which is to the Assyrians, because they had made alliance with Egypt and Ethiopia, and then prophet Isaiah. At that time, walking in the nude for 3 years through Jerusalem, to say, "What will happen to you if you make an alliance with Egypt and Assyria?" Which they did, and it meant the 701 siege of Jerusalem, which was that surprise ending when the Assyrian armies just left to fight in a more important place. And then 606, the Babylonians take over as the next world empire from the Assyrians. And then Judah, the southern kingdom, makes alliances with other nations. And so 587 the fall of Jerusalem to Babylon, the captivity in Babylon, the thousand mile, sometimes called the thousand mile Trail of Tears to Babylonian captivity. 538, the Edict of Cyrus, which meant the return of the Jewish people now under the Persian Empire, the return of the people to Jerusalem. And today we're going to look at the Persian period, which is 458 BCE and following, and the two leading people in this time. There is no king, no president, so these two emerge as the leaders of the people who have returned from Babylon and in the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the rebuilding from the devastation of the Babylonian invasion years before. Ezra is a priest and Nehemiah is a layperson. And they become the leaders. And then that Persian period goes until 333, the Hellenistic period, when the Hellenistic armies, Alexander the Great, conquered Jerusalem. So there will not be a test on this, but the Hellenistic period in Jerusalem begins. That's one of the easiest dates to remember in history, isn't it? 333. So, do you remember that, learning dates in school? I mean, well, now I'm going to just read some notes I've written. It'll be the introduction to moving towards the two stories that we'll look at today, which is Jonah and Ruth and Boaz. When the Babylonian armies overran Jerusalem, the city was destroyed, the palace destroyed, the walls destroyed, the temple leveled to the ground. The poorest were left behind, and those with skills, those educated, the ruling elites, were taken in chains on the 1,000-mile Trail of Tears to Babylon. And there they lived as exiles in a strange land for almost 50 years. Cyrus the Persian allowed the exiles to return home in 537. Those who returned to their ruined city believed their exile was God's punishment for their sin, their injustice, their worship of false gods. They vowed that they would never again worship other gods, faithful only to the God of Israel. And I think I'm right in saying from that point out, there was never again any movement of the worship of the fertility gods and goddesses of the surrounding people. The people now are repentant after the captivity and after the destruction. They vow to be pure and obedient before God and never again to run off to other gods. Now, the problem here now is one way to say it is they got too fervent. They got too fervent. And just when Yahweh, using kind of picture language, is smiling because they have returned to God and they have promised never to worship another god, and then it starts to be, something is beginning to bother me. These people are getting too serious about religion. Thank God ever says that. And this is what was happening. A new problem under the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah. They decided, and the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah decided to cast out of the community all foreign wives and their children so then they could be the pure people of God. And the sorrow and the grief and the tears and the crying would be beyond comprehension as you think of that scene of the women whom Jewish men had married in the time of the captivity, brought them home, and now they are forced to leave and walk all the way to the place from which they came. It's hard to imagine the crying and the tears and the grief in this over-enthusiasm to be the pure people of God. Now, I'm going to use some of my imagination now I think I have a guess of what Yahweh was thinking. I never say that without a lot of, I could be wrong. It's a very, very important little phrase. I'll never forget the little story that I might have exaggerated over the years, or it might, that Cliff Lundy was the bishop of the ALC in the Northwest. I'm sure you remember Cliff dearly, and I think if we were a native people, he would have been our shaman. He was a holy man, and when he died, the story was that they were cleaning out his desk, the office people, and they always remembered that when he came into his office each morning, he'd pull out a card and read it and put it back. So it was, wonder what was on that card. And they found it, and it said, "Remember, you could be wrong." Do you ever hear that story?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, it's probably, I don't know if it happened, but it's true. You get it? It's true. And now, the Ezra and Nehemiah had really lost their card. It could be wrong. Now, Yahweh, dear Yahweh, is looking and saying, "Now what shall I do? I gave them Moses and I gave them the covenant, and they disobeyed. And then I gave them the prophets. I was gentle with them because if I would have appeared face to face, they would have all died. So in my place, I sent the prophets. I sent Amos and Hosea and Isaiah. I sent Jeremiah. And they spoke these words, 'Return to me, for I am a God of steadfast love, and I will forgive all of your sins. Return to me.'" And the people would not listen to the prophets. And so they went to Babylon, and now they are back, and now they have taken religion too seriously. Now, what do I do? So Yahweh gets an idea. I have an idea. And it's, I'll send storytellers. Now, this is based on a theory that I have that some of you may have heard before, but every human being has a little invisible trapdoor in the back of one's head. And if someone comes up to you and confronts you with an idea that you disagree with, you're immediately going to put up your defenses, and that idea is just going to bounce off of this wall. So then if someone comes along and starts saying, "Let me tell you a story," and that wall starts going down, and then that story starts to hover over us, and then we gladly open the little trap door, and the story goes in, and it explodes in there, changing our lives. And we say, I don't even know how this happened, but our defenses were down, and we opened up the little door. So then, in this situation now, of the foreign wives, and that was coupled with a prejudice against other people. We are the true people of God. They are the wicked. So the first storyteller that God inspires is this one that just sits down with the people and says, let me tell you a story. Once upon a time, there was a man named Jonah. And God spoke to Jonah and asked Jonah to go to that wicked city of Nineveh and proclaim to them that their city would be destroyed if they did not repent. And Jonah heard the voice of God and said, I love to preach, but I think I'd rather go to the Spanish Riviera. And so Jonah gets on a boat. And on the boat, on his way, a storm. Oh, wrong story. Yeah, no, right. A storm comes and the ship is sinking. And the other sailors figure out it's Jonah and they throw him overboard. And then God sends a fish who swallows Jonah. And then Jonah is there rethinking his life. And then is vomited on the beach and says, thank God that's over. And then he stands up and then he remembers the call of God and now will go to Nineveh to preach. So he walks into Nineveh, and I make this part up. He decides to use his most boring sermon. And the reason he wants to preach his most boring sermon is that he's terribly afraid that these ninnies will repent and God will not destroy them. So he walks in and he preaches it as dull as possible. And lo and behold, a miracle happens. The Ninevites repent. Even the king repents. And even the cows repent. And Joseph goes into a tiff.
Jonah.
What?
Jonah.
What did I say?
Joseph.
Oh, yeah, that was Jonah's little helper. Oh, I could be wrong. Okay, so Jonah goes into a real snit, and he goes outside the city that is now repented, and God is going to withhold destruction on these wicked, evil people, and Jonah just cries out to Yahweh, I was afraid you would be merciful. You didn't disappoint me. I was afraid you would be merciful. And then Jonah just sits there under a little shade tree in the hot Iraqi sun. And then the tree wilts. And then God has a little talk with Jonah. Am I not to show mercy to a people who do not know their right hand from their left? And the story ends. and the hearers then who have received the story, some of them get it. Ah, we're Jonah. We're Jonah. We hate the outsider. We hate the enemy. And the story takes root. Okay, that's the first story. Now, notice the difference when the story is put in its context. Now, the assumption here is that the context of the Jonah story is the Ezra and Nehemiah period, and that's where I could be wrong. But whether it's true or not, I like to put it there, which has some valid scholarship behind it. But then God calls another storyteller, and God whispers to this story teller and says, tell them a love story. Tell them a love story. So this next storyteller goes around and tells about this woman, Naomi, I have to catch up with my notes here. If you're ever going to be a storyteller, don't do this.
I do it all the time.
You do. If you ever been up on the pulpit, you know.
Unnumbered pages.
Okay. Now I've got myself on track. Naomi and her husband Elimelech, they go to Moab. Now, if you think of the map, Moab would be across the Jordan River east of the Dead Sea up there, Moab. Now, again, we're talking about a foreign nation of those people. And they have two children, Mahlon and Chilion. And Mahlon and Chilion go with them to Moab because there's a famine in the land of Israel. And there, Mahlon and Chilion each marry a Moabite wife, Ruth and Orpah. Now the famine ends in Israel. They hear the word, and Naomi decides, and I have to back up here, Mahlon and Chilion and Elimelech have all died. So it's only Ruth and her two Moabite daughter-in-laws. Naomi hears about the end of the famine and decides to return to Bethlehem. Ruth and Orpah follow her as she begins her journey. And Naomi stops and says, go back to the house of your mothers. And so Orpah turns back to go to her people. But Ruth clings to Naomi. And then we have that beautiful, beautiful passage. Beloved, where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people. Your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there will I be buried. So Naomi returns to her people with Ruth, the Moabite. When she returns to Bethlehem, her home, it is the barley harvest. And now Ruth goes to join the gleaners at the time of the harvest. And she gleans without stopping. Now there's Boaz, who is the owner of the land. And Boaz notices her. And gives her water, gives her protection, from the dangers of a woman alone. And he compliments her on her gleaning. And Ruth says, Boaz, may I continue to find favor in your sight. The next day, Ruth continues the gleaning. And Boaz tells the reapers to cut sheaves and to spread them in front of where Ruth is gleaning, so she'll find more gleaning. The end of the day, she brings the barley to Naomi and tells her mother-in-law about Boaz. And then the next day, after she and her mother have had a talk, mother-in-law has told her what to do, and she follows her mother's instructions. First, she washes. She puts on her best clothing to clean and puts on perfume. And after the day's work, Boaz eats and then goes to his tent to sleep. Ruth sneaks in and she uncovers his feet that he does not wake up. And she lies down with her head on his feet. In the night, Boaz wakes up and sees a woman at his feet. Who are you? He says, I am Ruth, and you are my next of kin. Which is a way of saying, will you marry me? I am your next of kin. And Boaz is touched by this, but then says, Ruth, you've got to go out there and find some younger man. But she doesn't. But now the problem is, every indication in the story is that they are in love. This is a love story. The problem is another man in Bethlehem, also a kinsman, is more closely related to the family than is Boaz. And therefore, he has the first rights to redeem her, meaning she being a widow, there's all the rules about the family taking care of the woman by marrying the woman. And it's Elimelech, the same name as we had as the husband of Naomi. It's Elimelech who has the first rights to her. And Naomi and Ruth have a talk about this and decide their only choice is to go with what happens. There's no other choice. Now, Elimelech has the first choice. And by the way, in the Hebrew, Elimelech is called here Mr. So-and-so. So you get this drama building up of Boaz, the hero, and then Mr. So-and-so, who has the rights to Ruth. Are you feeling the tension building up? And Boaz finally decides if Mr. So-and-so wants to marry Ruth, he has no other choice. So he says, if he is not willing, I will marry you. Is this getting fun? I will marry you. Then so-and-so comes to Boaz and says, will you take my right of redemption? Because if I marry Ruth, I will also lose my land. And Boaz says, "Oh, that's too bad." No, he didn't. Boaz says, "Yes, yes, yes." Gathers 10 elders. There before the elders, Mr. So-and-so has first choice to acquire the land and Ruth, but he says he will not. And then the elders say to Boaz, "Will you take the right of redemption?" And Boaz says yes. And then according to the law of the land, Elimelech takes off one sandal off of his feet. And he holds up that sandal and says, "This is a sign. This is a sign that I give my right of redemption to Boaz." And now Boaz says, "I have acquired Ruth the Moabite, the wife of Malon, to be my wife." And the people cry out, "May Ruth be like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel." And they marry, and they bear a son. And Naomi takes the baby into her arms, and they name him Obed. And now, as you're completely taken in by this story, the story says one more thing. I'd like to add this, that Ruth was a Moabite. And Ruth's ancestors, Ruth's descendants, Ruth and Boaz, are the descendants of finally King David. And then this means they are the parents of the line of the Messiah of Israel. And just to really work it in, I counted, and it's 12 times in this short story of Ruth and Boaz, 12 times that the storyteller says the word Moabite, or Ruth the Moabite, or Ruth the foreigner. Now, what do you think? How would this sound on their ears when they hear this story? I apologize, I don't have the story down quite as well as the Jonah. Thank you for... But what do you think?
I think it's like a good poem. You're kind of following it through. It's just kind of washing over you until you get to the last line. And there's the zing of the last line.
The
clincher. Obed was the father of Jesse, and Jesse was the father of David, or however that line goes.
Yeah, probably did.
And normally those genealogies are so boring.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll read the last zinger. They named him Obed. He became the father of Jesse, the father of David. And now these are the descendants of Perez. Where did Perez come in? Perez became the father of Hezron, Hezron of Ram, Ram of Salmon of Boaz. These are the ancestors, right? And then Salmon of Boaz, Boaz of Obed, Obed of Jesse, and Jesse of David. Zing, zing, zing. Oh. What do you think?
So there, Ezra.
But I hope I got across how a story would pull you in, and then you are completely vulnerable to the truth. And then it kind of blows up inside of you and changes you. Oh. And what's better than a love story?
Dan, where are these stories being told? I mean, I know they're oral and they're over and over, and are they being told around the campfires or in the temples or both? Or,
oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a guess, but you know, if you you imagine that, like in the winter, how long the night is and it's completely dark and there's no electricity.
Sounds like Holden.
What?
Sounds like Holden.
Yeah, no electricity. You know, and you have hours before you go to sleep in the dark. What do you do?
Tell stories.
Yeah, you tell stories. You tell stories of the ancestors. And you tell stories of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Rachel, and Rebecca, and you tell them over and over. Now, does that make sense?
I worry a little bit because stories change in the retelling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I think one of the theories about that change is that the change that lasts is when that story is sort of taken over by a master storyteller. And the change that takes place is part of that master storyteller's gift. And that part is an addition to the story, but builds the story rather than taking away from the story. No, I think it goes the other way too. But.
Yes, Jim.
One of the things I've always loved about this story is that it undermines some of our stereotypes or expectations about love. And the first of these, you know how often Ruth, I think it's like a song that she, song of love that she sings to her mother-in-law. Mother-in-laws get a hard rap in the first place. I don't know if that was true then, but, you know, they are foreign to each other's culture. Yet they've overcome that. They have this bond. And that song is sung or told, recounted at wedding services, most of which have been heterosexual marriages.
Mm-hmm.
And often people don't realize that it's one woman singing to another woman.
Yeah.
That's the first one. And then the second one is the Ruth Boaz love story. You know, that undermines a number of expectations too. And I think for some women today, it's difficult to think that Ruth would submit herself like that. Of course, it's a cultural necessity, isn't it?
Yeah.
That she has a man to be attached to in order to survive in the culture.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, she's obeying Naomi, isn't she?
Mm-hmm.
She's taking a tip from her.
Yeah. And part of it I love that, you know, connects it to yesterday's story. This is another example of women who do not have power that are very, very bright and figure it out, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
They make the plan. And it's a really expert storyteller. Think how you'd be drawn in this. As Ruth is kind of crawling along the ground towards the tent, you know, slipping in there and uncovering his feet, and then putting her head down on his feet. This is risky.
Do you think it's a story of seduction?
Mm-hmm. What's that?
Do you think it's a story of seduction?
No. well, maybe. But, there are... the laws of these societies are very complicated. I'm still trying to figure it out, but it had something to do with, because marriage was a contract.
Mm-hmm.
But it must have been some way of saying I would be available.
Yeah, kind of a broad hint, right?
Yeah, broad hint. A woman wouldn't want to come out and do it too.
I think one of the things that spares Ruth from being labeled a seductress is that her bond with Naomi is so strong.
Mm-hmm.
And it flows out of that, not out of so-called feminine wiles or something. Mm-hmm. You know, I just, that's the way I try to appreciate the cultural context.
Yeah, and it's also survival, and in that society, she's going to be married to somebody, and Mr. So-and-so is number one. I mean, there's no romance involved in marriage, and this part of it is, this exception is that the law gets bent so Boaz can marry Ruth, but there is romance, isn't there, in this? In spite of all of the laws and all of it.
This is also sort of a winter-spring relationship. He's older, she's younger. And the fact that this could be a successful relationship.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, that's been turned around a little bit in our time, where you now have not only an older man and a younger woman, but now you see younger men really finding the value of a relationship to an older woman.
Mm-hmm.
And entering that kind of relationship.
Yeah, I never thought of that, but one factor is this is a different generation marriage, isn't it?
Can you say anything about how this finds its particular place in the canon? How did it get in? And what would those who brought it in think if they could hear our discussion of it?
Mm-hmm.
In a thoroughly modern vein. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's plunked down between what?
Judges.
Joshua and
Judges,
Judges and Samuel?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's Joshua, Judges,
is
Ruth.
It?
And then,
well, it becomes kind of chronology in that sense, because you lead from the period of the Judges, and then there's a little touch of prehistory to the story of the kings. This is the story of, here comes King David, just a little bit down the line.
Uh-huh. I would guess it's a preparation for the David stories.
So, and I think perhaps by the time the rabbis start pulling the canon together, what was it, 77 AD, this story had really worked itself through the culture pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And are we to understand that Mr. So-and-so gives up his rights to Boaz out of economic reasons and
uh-huh.
personal selfishness?
Exactly.
He'll lose some financial
mm-hmm.
advantage if he does this. That helps make the, you know, love wins out, or you know, generosity wins out over selfishness. Intensifies the love story.
And think throughout history how often marriage has been basically an economic or political arrangement.
Yeah.
And here's this little witness to romance.
Yeah.
And
when did the Talmud get written?
The Talmud meaning Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus.
My understanding of the Talmud is
commentary. I was thinking of the Torah. The Talmud, some of you can help me
it's
with this, but it was
post-biblical age.
Yeah.
And the Talmud leads into the Mishnah, but the Talmud is, I think, really right kind of in process, just as the New Testament age is sort of taking place, and just right after the New Testament age, and then the Mishnah becomes commentary on the Talmud.
Yeah. And
so all those are stories that were just oral, and then they put it into writing?
The Talmud is a mixture of legal, it's two kinds of midrash. You've got Haggadah and Halakha. So you have legal commentary and you've got story commentary.
Mm-hmm.
And you find both of those in Talmud and Mishnah.
Have you read the commentary on this story?
No, I haven't.
No, it would be fun to do. And if you want... If you want to hear more of this, Rabbi Marks was here this summer, and his CDs would be in there. But, he's a great teacher and a friend of the village. He's been here twice. So. Was he good? Oh, no, you weren't here yet. Nobody was here yet. The Talmud also came out of after the fall of Jerusalem, when there really was no nation anymore. There was no land. There was no. So it was really the people become the people of the book. And it's the book that ties them together under the great rabbis at the time, shortly after the New Testament. After the, or more accurate is to talk about the fall of Jerusalem. And those early rabbis are the ones that held Judaism together.
I may be wrong, but I think there are actually two Talmuds. One originates in Babylon with the exile community in Babylon, and the other originates in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
They're related.
What year was David born, or approximately?
1000. Am I right?
Yep.
Yes.
That's the easiest Bible date.
Yeah. Along with 333.
But what are you putting this Ruth story way up here in 458, between 458 and 333?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The context of the story is ancient Israel. The story most likely came out of the period of Ezra and Nehemiah.
It's like telling a historical novel. You know, you got to go back in history. And to a certain extent, I think it's the same with Jonah. There seems to have been a historical prophet by the name of Jonah, but that was earlier in history.
Yeah.
And the book of Jonah is later on sort of built somewhat, perhaps, on this historical figure.
Yeah. Let's bring this up to date. You know, what happens today in our nation about foreigners, outsiders, those who are considered not truly Americans, the immigrants, the what are called the illegal immigrants that come to do the work nobody else would do, and on and on and on. This is the spirit of Jonah and the spirit of Ruth certainly are current. And how would you apply these stories today? Or what might they mean?
I think among the two groups that are sort of part of the story are Hispanic folk, though the number of Hispanic folk is growing, and I think that may well change. The other group at this point is folk of Arabic background,
mm-hmm.
who are really placed in this other category.
Yeah. I stay at a motel near SeaTac sometimes before going on the trips because it's this motel is you stay one night and you get a week of free parking, and it's only $75 for the room. So don't go there like if it's a big anniversary. But this, I realized when I read the news that the owner of this motel, the family that runs it, are Sikhs. And right after 9/11, someone came off the street into the motel with a baseball bat and hit the owner over the head because he looked like an Arab or a Muslim. And he was hospitalized and is okay. So I asked him about it once when I was checking in, and he was so proud to open a drawer just behind the desk, and this door was just filled to overflowing with letters from all over the United States, saying, people saying they were sorry, and he was so, felt so received by this nation, by this outpouring of letters. And the reason the attacker said, well, I already mentioned that, because he wasn't an Arab at all and he wasn't a Muslim, but he just looked like one. And I also think the witness that some Christian churches made at that time of, I know, was it in Linwood, and it was other places where Christian people surrounded the mosque and kept 24-hour watch at the different mosques to protect them from being vandalized. And I think that is so Ruth.
And there was sharing of food and all kinds of things that happened at this point.
Yeah.
And I think right now, just to realize, it seems the ones that are being the hardest hit are the high school age Islamic people.
They are.
Anything we can do to be friends, do something, as well, it's rough to be a young Arab, young Islamic person right now.
Yeah. Do many of us have elbows with Muslim people, or are they fairly distant?
We're right in it.
What?
We're right in it. We have a son-in-law from Muslim.
Mm-hmm. And a daughter.
And a daughter.
And a granddaughter. Mm-hmm. And she speaks Arabic. Yeah. 20 more. Mm-hmm. Working on the streets are challenges. I honestly feel that the most appreciative people that I work with are...
Could you talk a little louder, please?
That the most appreciative people that I work with on the streets are Islam. It's amazing.
We had a really terrible thing happen in Anchorage right after 9/11 that undid so badly, because a man who had been very active in the community and owned his own big printing business and everything, and about a week after September 11, it was totally vandalized and nasty racial things written on the walls and everything, graffiti. And the community immediately got behind it and were invited especially to give money to help, you know, put this family back on their feet and everything and restore his business. And many, many, many of us did that. A lot of money was immediately collected. And then within 2 months they found that he had done this himself to take advantage. So all the progress of people really wanting to be supportive and really pitching in, and then it's just flip-flopped in our faces, and it made a difference in the community for a long while.
Those whom are looked down upon are also sinners. That can happen. I'm going to close with just a very brief story. This is when I served in Albuquerque, and one of our members of the church was married to a Pakistani Muslim, and he was a very secular guy, you know, with really didn't practice his religion, but he, because of a disease, he had to have a leg amputation, and so he was in the hospital preparing for this, and so making my rounds, I stopped in to see him because he was married to one of our members. And one time, just before the surgery, or the amputation, he asked if I would hold his hand as he recommitted himself to submission to God. And right, all of a sudden, all of my wheels were turning, like all my missionary teaching and LBI, where we had classes on how to convert everybody. And I think, one of the most precious moments of my life to hold his hand as he made his recommitment to being, as Islam means, submission to God. And so I'll close with that. And tomorrow we are going to do Amos. And Amos and the taking off of sandals. So, thank you.
Thank you.